Hi friends, how are you? Welcome back. It is episode 2 of season 3 and you are very welcome here to join us listening to Royston Collins. Royston shares with us his lack of surprise almost at a late life diagnosis of ADHD and his story about coming out and living with neurodivergence as a proud gay man, what that looks like, how that feels, and as always a kind of really good heartwarming conversation to kind of warm your cockles, as it were. So let's dive right in. We're going to hear straight from Royston, but for now, hunker down, chill out, relax and listen in to The Safe Place.
Thank you, everyone, for inviting me along to join the Safe Place podcast. Apologies if I might be a bit nervous. I don't often do podcasts, so this will be interesting. And yeah, my name's Royston Collins. I'm one of the directors at Genius Within. And I have been with Genius Within for about 5 years. And Genius Within is a small company in Lewes in East Sussex that specializes in supporting neurodivergent adults in the workplace to really be at their best more of the time. And we do that through a number of ways. So we do it through diagnosis, we do it through support in terms of coaching, we do some training for businesses and we do consultancy for businesses. But we also do a lot of work for our community too. So we do a lot of work within the social justice sector. So particularly supporting the unemployed, the long-term unemployed, to find and gain meaningful employment. We know there's a huge proportion of neurodivergent adults that struggle with employment. And we also support individuals coming out of prison. So supporting them to learn and gain new skills and move into the working world. And we absolutely love what we do. We're really passionate about it.
It's all what I would term as good work.
Yeah, it's fantastic. We really do enjoy it. And you know, to some extent, we're one of the leaders in the market in doing this. The models we use are quite unique. And we have some of the highest sort of outcomes, really, compared to, you know, our peers or our other companies that we work alongside. We're one of the highest performing providers that support all these different ventures as well. So something really to be proud of.
And how did you kind of come to work in that? Because I always say with organizations that deal with this type of stuff is they're relatively niche. They shouldn't be, but they generally are, because unfortunately we haven't got these massive organizations that are there to look after us as, yeah, as people that are either disabled or neurodivergent. So how did you come to getting involved?
Wow, let me give you a bit of a potted history, I think, because that will probably explain a little bit about my journey. So yeah, I'm nearly 50, so I've had quite a few years of working life. I did pretty well at school. So yeah, school wasn't really a problem. I really enjoyed it right through sort of my GCSEs and part of my A-levels. But I'm a proud member of the LGBT community. I've always been quite open about it, and probably a little bit too early to be open about it when I was at school. So I was relentlessly bullied. And towards the end of my school career, I kind of hated it. You know, my educational career. And so I quickly left. So all the way while I was doing my studies, I was working anyway. So I was working part-time. I used to work in retail. I adored it. I'm a real chatty person. I'm a people person. So I loved retail. And then as I got towards the end of my studies, my mum started putting some pressure on to say, oh, you know, you need a real job. Go out and find a real job. You can't work in shops your entire life. So I bowed to that sort of peer pressure. And I ditched the whole thing and went to work for Lloyds Banking Group. Now, it was very interesting working at Lloyds Banking Group. It's not my style at all. It was, you know, in an actual branch, a Lloyds Banking branch, primarily selling things like insurance. It didn't really match my skills at all. And I didn't enjoy it. And being the type of person I am, when I'm not enjoying something, I tend to move on or do something different. And so I did. So I packed it all in. I ended up going to work for a few months in a coffee shop while I saved a few pennies. And then I went off to New York for a few years and lived there running a bar with some of my friends, completely flighty, completely different, and lived in Brooklyn, New York, and ran a bar in New York for nearly 5 years. So yeah, it was really interesting. Now, the interesting thing is I've always been pretty much in front of people. You know, I love, the bar work was great. I was always talking to people all the time. You can imagine what it's like when you're, you know, always talking to people. So I kind of found that was my gift. You know, just to be around people and talk to people and listen to the stories and empathize and tell stories. And then I came back to the UK not long after the Twin Towers came down, actually, because my mum was having a bit of a freak out. And I went to work with a care company. So I fell into the care sector because of Nancy, who's one of my friends and colleagues, Professor Nancy Doyle, who's the current or is the founder of Genius Within. So Nancy and I have known each other since we were teenagers. And when I moved back to the UK, there was a job going in the office in this care business that Nancy said, oh, come and do it. I think you'd be great. And I did. So I did that for a really long time, really, really long time. And it was a care agency. And again, I was working with people and I was supporting adults with disabilities. I was supporting older people. I just absolutely loved it. I really loved it. And then we moved to Brighton. So the office moved to Brighton, or they opened an office in Brighton, and I ended up down on the South Coast. And then eventually I moved into adult social care, so working for the council, which I did for 11 or 12 years. So really, really long time, you know, public sector job. Everyone's like, oh, that's really cushy being public sector, you know, got your nice pension and whatnot. So yeah, and I loved that as well. And again, I was doing a similar thing. I was working with people, I was supporting adults to find things like care homes and care agencies and all of those kinds of things. And again, it was another job I really, really enjoyed. And I wouldn't have ever considered leaving it unless, you know, things hadn't changed. The council work is kind of political. There's a lot of political games that go on in councils or in local authority bodies and those kind of things. And it got to me a little bit. And then Nancy reached out to me, interestingly, for a couple of years, saying, oh, come work with me, come work with me, come work with me. I've got Genius Within, come work with me. And I kept saying no. Then eventually I was like, do you know what? I'm going to take the leap and I'm going to jump. And I moved into Genius Within. And I feel like I found a home at Genius Within. So at Genius Within, there's people like me. You know, there's neurodivergent adults like me. I am a neurodivergent adult. I was fortunate enough to go through a diagnosis process about 18 months ago. And that really impacted on me in a really sort of positive way going through that process, because I've always known I've been slightly different, I would say. And there might have been different reasons for being slightly different. So being quite open and honest and quite frank most of the time. But actually going through a diagnosis process was really sort of cathartic and really helpful. And it made me understand a lot about me, and it made me understand a lot about the overlaps between, you know, neurodivergence, between LGBTQI issues. You know, it was such a great thing to do. And I really do feel like I'm at home at Genius Within now. So yeah, that's my little potted history.
And this, I mean, for a little potted history, there is a lot in that. I mean, I find it really interesting when people talk about working in banking and effectively kind of falling into it, because that's exactly what I did. So I worked in retail because I could talk to people. I was, you know, described as the gift of the gab back then, but really it was just me just nonstop talking. And then I literally walked into a bank one day and got a job as a teller or cashier or whatever terminology you want to use, and then did the same thing that I did in retail but in banking. I worked in banking for about 15 years in some way, shape or form, never feeling like I fitted in, which is something I think a lot of people experience in the financial services sector, because it's got this big kind of guise of being this stuffy corporate, just suits kind of the place that, must wear a tie, you must wear black shoes, black suits, white shirt, red tie. That was literally one of my first days, but I never did wear ties. I don't like ties. Sorry, tie makers out there, but just not for me. So I used to wear a dicky bow instead because that was more me. That was more representative of who I was and what I'm comfortable wearing. But I was, for a long time, forced into wearing a tie when I first joined. I managed to not wear the black suit because I'm not a black suit person at all, and a white shirt, but I kind of let myself fall into the trap wearing a tie. And you just fall into these things, don't you? You just fall into
the
organization.
Yeah.
And sometimes.
And I was similar. I didn't fit in.
Yeah. There you go.
I was the same. I felt I didn't fit in there. It wasn't me. I just did it.
Yeah. And that's, in some ways, there are definitely aspects that I enjoyed. I enjoyed being successful because I did pretty well. I was good at the job, mainly because. Mm. Yeah, I could talk to people. I understood the products that I was selling. I refused to sell badly, even though lots of managers didn't like that. So I didn't do the whole, let's sell PIP. Let's sell, add-on products that just aren't the right thing for the customer ultimately. So, low insurance and all these type of things that,
yes,
we now know to be very dodgy. but you've got to really know how to almost advocate for yourself, but also have that kind of stubbornness that just gets and becomes exhausting. It's something that I think a lot of people that I know that have worked in banking, particularly kind of 5-10 years ago, in the disability community, they've kind of found it difficult, at least.
Yeah,
it's not the norm. I also love that you lived in New York. That's one of my lifelong dreams, is to live and work in New York. I've not made it happen yet. It becomes less likely every year.
I don't think my parents were particularly happy about that. As I, I think the intention was for me to go shopping for a couple of weeks, but I just never came back for about 5 years.
What was it like over there? That's what you left in 2004, was it? Somewhere around that sort of time, 2004, 2005.
No, 2001 was when I came back here, so late 90s we're talking.
Yeah, gosh, yeah, okay. So I was in school.
Yeah,
late 90s. The anchor point for me is that, I shouldn't have got the date wrong really, but it's because I went to New York for the first time ever literally just after the towers fell. So it was the February after. And that was the first time that I'd ever visited, and it was just the best city in the world, even though there's something so significant that happened.
Yeah.
Very cool.
During that time, I was back and forward a few times in between then, because I was already considering, living back in the UK permanently. And when you've sort of lived somewhere for quite a few years, you gather a load of stuff, don't you? And I was just like bringing things back and forward, and which was fine. It was really interesting living there. I mean, New York's a little bit like London. You've got, a real melting pot of genuine New Yorkers, but a huge melting pot of different cultures, different nationalities, which is amazing because, it's very East Coast America, really. No one's the same. It's not a homogenous sort of culture there. So I just loved it. I absolutely loved it.
And what did you find in terms of the differences of being an outwardly kind of gay man in New York compared to being outwardly in the UK? Because the UK is quite stuffy. Let's be honest.
It is stuffy. Yeah. Yeah. Well, Nancy's always had, and she's known me since I was a teenager. So Nancy always had an idea that I probably was gay. I didn't have many girlfriends. And it was interesting that not long after I'd actually moved to New York was when I actually came out formally or properly.
Yeah. Okay.
And Nancy was a bit like, oh, do you know what? Yeah, I'm not surprised, and was really supportive. So, and really from that point on, I think I was genuinely more open about it. From the early 2000s. So I think prior to that, a few close friends knew. My family didn't know. I wasn't open to my family. I'd kept it quite close because it was always such a thing that was shameful. And, you know, I'd never heard any positive stories about, being in the LGBT community. And also going through it at school was horrendous. And we had Thatcher and Section 28 and, you know, all the other horrible things that were going on at the time. It was just, you just didn't put your hand up. You just didn't say anything. You just got on with it. which is a shame.
It's one of the many histories that you can look back at, and there's lots of individual good stories of people having good experiences and that sort of stuff. But as a whole, it's not a nice history telling, really. Lots of discrimination, lots of kind of negative consequences of just being who you are. I mean, how ridiculous is it? That sort of thing happens.
I don't know that it's changed much now, though. I mean, yes, it's massively improved, certainly here in the UK. But I mean, I live in Brighton, which is supposed to be one of the most liberal cities in the world. But even here, sometimes, you know, we have people being attacked and all sorts. And I've been mugged before on the streets of Brighton. I've had people throwing slurs and things. So it does happen. It doesn't matter what, you know, I don't think we get away from it completely. But things are better. I have to say they are better.
Yeah. I mean, I guess to a certain extent, could they get much worse? I suppose. I wonder how you feel about what's going on at the moment, though, with, and this is very relevant, very recent, with the guidance that's been issued around trans people within the school environment. Kind of feels to me like that's a, I don't know if attack's the right word.
It's a punch in the gut is what it is.
Yeah. And kind of feels reminiscent of what people were finding with coming out as being gay, lesbian, bisexual. It kind of feels reminiscent of that, and that kind of that part of the community seemed to be going through to something.
It is. I mean, it's
similar.
It is another attack, I think. I think one of the things that I'm most surprised about is it's quite regressive. So, kids will be kids. You know, let's not get that wrong. Kids will be kids. But actually, there are children that mature very quickly that understand that they are different. You know, I mean, if I think back to when I was at school, I knew I was in the gay community from probably about 7 or 8. And this, you know, if things were different then, we wouldn't be having these conversations now. But they're not. We've gone back to it. So I think with this new guidance, the most damning thing about the guidance is that it's not recognizing these children or these people as human beings. It's treating them as outcasts, which I think is extremely damaging. It overlaps with neurodivergence. You know, we know that, for example, in the autistic community, is about 3% of the population are autistic, 2 to 3%. But within the trans community, that's around 30%. So, you know, it's a big connection there. So it's really interesting. But yeah, going back to the guidance, they've not used human terms. You know, they've not referred to people as children. They've used quite negative and disparaging language. There's a very big push for what they're calling identity ideology, gender ideology. And, you know, all of these terms are all coming from, well, I don't want to say it so bluntly, but they're coming from hate groups. They're coming from groups that have nothing to do with our trans communities. Here in Brighton, we've got a big trans community. You know, I've got trans friends. And I just think it's very, very hard at the minute. And I think there'll be quite a lot of challenges. And conversely, the other thing is that none of it aligns with any of the Equality Act or the Children's Act. You know, schools are going to be in a lot of trouble by trying to follow this guidance. And they'll be open to challenge.
Yeah, it's a really relevant point, because there is they're not the best laws, let's be honest. This could certainly be improved, and I would certainly advocate for improving of the Equality Act in particular, because I don't think in many ways it's fit for purpose for the disability community in particular. I'm sure the same applies to other communities that aren't just not as involved in. But how do you go from having one of these piece of legislation that require organizations, schools, services, service providers, employers to do certain things and meet certain standards, but then have guidance that's come from the government that effectively says something different?
Mm-hmm.
Now, yeah, somebody somewhere has got to get challenged on this, and it will be, I'm sure, an interesting legal case. It's a legal case that should never have to happen, because you just shouldn't have, in 2023, a government giving guidance on how to treat people that are going through schools and how to treat children. But let's not forget, these are young children that are going through their critical periods in lives and having enough hate as it is from their peers, let alone from their teachers, for Christ's sake.
Absolutely. You know, and the annoying thing is they're being used as a political football, the same as we are seeing with migrants. I think it's a real shame. And the trouble is, at the very center of it is a young trans child or a young person that's being kicked around. And I will do everything I can to challenge that. You know, I see I've got friends that have got young trans children. And I will advocate for them. So, yeah, I will be. If they're marching, I'm marching.
And rightly so. I struggle to be part of marches from a physical perspective. Getting anywhere outside of my home is difficult, let alone getting to down to London, where most of these marches might be, or down south. Mm-hmm. But I just kind of feel like there almost has to be fairly large disruptive marches for that, but also not just for that, because we kind of talk about the kind of issues that are confronting populations at the moment, and there's this that was released yesterday, which is just at very best badly written, poorly thought out guidance, and at worst just plain horrific, and so that should never have been published. But it's not the only thing that we found recently. I mean, if we think about representation of different communities, we've also had the change from ministerial positions, and you kind of mentioning immigration brought a wry smile from me, because the disability minister, or former disability minister, had been moved over to migration, I think is what they're calling it, rather than immigration.
Yeah.
As the representative, and the disability minister role has been downgraded to the most junior role in government.
Yeah.
It just seems like at the moment, anything that can be used against populations is kind of a target almost. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about that? How does that make you feel?
Well, it makes me feel like saying Tories out, to be honest, but it's a real shame. I really see there are a few members of cabinet that actually go out of their way to really champion good work, but the government seems hell-bent on destroying everything and putting barriers in place. I don't think we're going to see any change until the next general election. I certainly wouldn't vote for them. But it makes me very angry, whether it's, ministers for women or ministers for disabilities or whatever. It just seems they're getting it wrong at the minute, and they're not listening to the community. Or the communities, and I think that is far more dangerous. Currently just spending their time listening to, anti-trans groups or to ableist groups, I think is just damning.
Yeah, I just kind of feel like even with the Tories gone, I look at Labour as being the main alternative for the moment. I don't even feel that comfortable with kind of their narrative on it. They're more outspoken, which is good, but actions speak words, and when I look for representation in politics as an example, and representation across the board, it just isn't there.
No,
not obviously anyway. And I appreciate that there's there's people that have disabilities and sexual preferences that, or not preferences, that's the wrong word, but sexual orientation that, yeah, don't talk about it all the time, and it's not visibly obvious, so they're not in a wheelchair, as an example.
Yeah.
But it kind of comes down to the same point as representation, that if you're in a position of power and responsibility, and yeah, you are from that community, why wouldn't you want to speak out? Why wouldn't you want to be the voice that enables others to kind of have a bell life? Just boggles my mind.
It's interesting down here in Brighton, because locally, our Labour Party, I would say, are fairly good, and they're quite representative. So we have got LGBT members on the council. You know, we've got good representation across the LGBT community as a whole. But when you look at the wider Labour Party, they've got members that are actively anti-LGBT, and they don't do it, you know, they don't challenge it, and they let things slide. And I think that internal fighting within a party can't be united if they've got those issues those issues internally. And I agree with you, it makes it very hard to decide who I'm voting for next time.
I think I know who I will probably end up voting for, because it'll be a tactical vote to make sure that we have a change of government. And for me, it's down to many reasons. So there's some personal reasons that, you know, as a disabled individual, I feel like I'm being more marginalized than I was 13 years ago. But also because of how the kind of current government has interacted with different organizations, and how they've either helped or not different people. There's just too much that kind of makes me think, we really do need change, and I don't see how that's going to come from the status quo. I wonder then how from a kind of charitable perspective and working within Genius Within, how on earth you navigate all of the kind of macro and kind of political pieces that are and have been going on for some time.
Away from Genius Within, did you say?
Within.
Oh, well, I mean, I love Genius Within. We're a really inclusive company, you know, from our board down to the, you know, every single employee. We've got great representation within ourselves. We have a majority, 67% disabled or neurodivergent. We have a wide range of Black community members as well, LGBT members. You know, we're a nice little melting pot, actually, and I love that. And we're just about to do our ethnicity pay gap reports in January as well, so that, you know, we like to buck the trend of being stuffy sort of corporate. We're not stuffy in corporate, we're all quite chatty and social, and we listen to our community. So, you know, we know that, you know, within the trans community, there's a huge proportion of neurodivergent individuals. Within LGBTQ communities, there's, you know, a large proportion of neurodivergent individuals. So those intersections are really quite broad, you know, and also with adults that are in our group that are either in disability communities or within prison communities, you can see there's huge overlaps everywhere. So we're kind of in a fortunate place that we get to hear lots of different perspectives and lots of different narratives. And actually, I think that makes us better. You know, we breathe on that. We live on that, and we bring it into our services to support people. And I think that's really important.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. It's how organizations should be run. I mean, how was it Accenture that, a report recently around the effectively the benefit of having disabled people in an organization, and it was some crazy to get, I'm going to get this wrong, and my bad, but it was something daft like a 3% increase it might even be 30% increase in baseline profit of an organization as a result of having a more diverse this workforce. And basically, yep. what they went did was look around different employers, look at the diversity stats, look at more diverse and less diverse in similar kind of professions, industries, to understand what that looks like. That's really simplifying it, and it's not probably not a fair assessment. but the work that they've actually done, but it kind of shines a light on how important it is to get it right. And it's nice to
it
see
does.
That yeah, you're as an organization, you're kind of leading the way on that. You're doing the things that you kind of expect to be done. And I guess some of that comes from you kind of almost can't tell other people to do it unless you're doing it yourself.
Yeah.
Because yeah, it's a bit of irony in doing that.
We call it walking our talk. So you know, it's interesting you talk about there being a definitive benefit to having a diverse team. There's been several pieces of research on it now, and while I personally, it doesn't really align with my values, because it's basically what we're saying is that everybody's got a value, and you know, if you do something a certain way, it's worth more money. It's commoditizing neurodivergence to some extent. I know it has its benefits, but when you're talking about business, that's the sort of thing they want to see. That, you know, and I get it. If they want to invest in their ERGs, or they want to invest in their diversity and equity and inclusion policies, they want to see a return on investment, an ROI. So that kind of research is, you know, it is important. But it grates on me a little bit. But I mean, if you look at the work of Neurodiversity in Business, which is the sort of national charity in the UK, so Neurodiversity in Business is, we're members of it. Just last year, we did a huge piece of research on adjustments in the workplace and people's intention to stay with employers based on how inclusive they are. It's just relaunched again now, ready for next year. If you're neurodivergent, you're listening, you want to have your say, look up the research on neurodiversity in business, and you know, make your vote count. It's important. That kind of research is very useful.
I'll pop it in the show. I'll pop it in the show notes as well, so that there's a link to that, because any way of getting more of a voice to people is important, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
It is an interesting thing that we have all these different research pieces, all these different stats. And most things come down to what is the financial benefit of X, Y, and Z. I would love it to not be the thing that drives change, and that actually people just do it because it's the right thing to do. I think we're fairly far away from moving away from that type of kind of research, or the need for that type of research.
Yeah.
I agree. Like you said, there's also some really good, interesting, and insightful kind of research out there, like the neurodiverse kind of research that goes on, that tells us about, you know, the impacts of the changes that we can make in the organization. I mean, as an example, I've left organizations because their adjustments process has been lackluster, to say the least. Mm-hmm. Why would I stay? Why would I stay somewhere that doesn't benefit me ultimately?
Yeah.
You've got the knock-on cost of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, from our perspective at Genius Within, we want to see businesses become what we call in truly neuro-inclusive. You know, if somebody comes into work, you know, even the word adjustments gets my goat a little bit, because actually you're just providing tools for somebody to work at their best more of the time. So why do we not offer that at the start? You know, as soon as somebody comes, what do you need to do the best at your interview? What do you need to, you know, be your best in the office? What do you need to be your best at your home environment? Those are the kinds of things that really fire me up and get me passionate. And when I see companies say, well, we can't do that unless you've got a diagnosis, or you need to provide this, or you need to provide that, you have to jump through this hoop, you have to go swimming across this lake of lava, that really is very, very difficult. And yet you can see from research the benefits of providing, appropriate support or appropriate tools from the get-go. Um, better engagement, better productivity, you know, better outcomes for employees, better well-being, better mental health. All of those things come into play just by behaving slightly differently. So yeah, I think it's really, really, really important to, you know, kind of focus on that. Let's push the neuro-inclusion agenda.
Yeah, and the thing that I always kind of fall back on with this type of thing is that ultimately, if you want to constantly adapting and evolving and improving organization, you need diversity of thought. You need that difference in views, of opinions, of just ways of thinking, which obviously is very much the kind of neurodivergent population. And you can't have that in that little pocket of the the kind of cisgendered white middle-aged man, which, yeah, I mean, I kind of broadly fall into these days, which is not what I want to talk about getting older. But yeah, you can't have that with just that one population, which is historically what we've had. You don't get the growth out of organizations. Yeah. You don't get the kind of change that we need. Where you do, you have people that are able to challenge in an effective way, they're able to bring something different to that conversation, bring a different viewpoint. It might be that it's because you had a more difficult upbringing because you were in care, as an example. That's a different viewpoint. It could be that it's because you're neurodivergent or disabled. It could be that you've acquired a disability or that you're born with it.
Yeah.
I could go on. I won't, because it'll bore me, but I could go on. And all of that ultimately brings that diversity of thought to the table, which means that you can be more effective in what you're doing.
Totally.
It isn't any more complicated than that.
Yeah, absolutely. And even some of the research, there was some research not long ago done by, I think it was by the ILM, where they were looking at, or they canvassed managers as part of this research with regards to employing different neurotypes or different individuals or adults with disabilities or, you know, various different sort of sectors, really. And the primary concern was actually kind of an ignorance. So managers didn't know how to work with, you know, autistic staff, or didn't know how to approach people from different communities. And I think that's such a shame, because they are missing out on that diversity of thought. And I think it's really important to push, you know, ahead and constantly challenge. Because you're right, you can't have a homogenous business that's, you know, just all white middle-aged men, cisgender men, you know, doing all the same things. They'll churn out the same rubbish year after year. You know, you want that diversity of thought. You want those entrepreneurial skills. You want that different thinking. You want people that have had different upbringings to, like you say, to challenge, to say, well, that won't work for our community. So what are you going to do differently? How do you adapt? So yeah, it's a key thing.
Yeah, and I think that kind of intersectionality point, which is effectively what we're talking about here, is the within different communities. So you've got very obvious kind of programs at work at the moment. So ethnic programs and gender-based programs are the two big kind of ticket items that I would say most organizations now are doing. But I think that the organizations often forget that actually, if you looked at the disability population that is within your workforce, and whilst you might not think it, you will have people that are disabled in your workforce, whether that's because they're neurodivergent, whether because they've got a physical disability that's on display or isn't on display. There will be them, because we make up around about 20% of the population, if not more.
Absolutely.
You know, which figures you kind of take. So if you then look at it as a population, as a community, you're going to have every single other community within that community is just a volume of people. It just, that's the way it is. So why wouldn't you start at, right, let's make sure we get this right, because that will lead on to make sure we get everything else right as well. That's the bit that I struggle with when I'm speaking to people, is getting people to understand that actually the importance of getting it right for disabled community in particular means that you've got a better chance of getting it right across the board.
Absolutely.
Whether it be for employees or customers.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. I've seen businesses that are, you know, focusing on one particular area, and then they ask us for advice about neurodivergence, for example, but they say, oh, but we can't afford to do neurodivergence this year. We're doing, ethnic diversity. And I'm like, just do diversity. Just do the whole thing as diversity. Just bring it all in. You know, pull your budgets, bring it all in. Let's just do a whole piece within your company, because there will be a huge intersection. And it's quite funny because you do see some of the same faces across different areas as well. So, yeah, it's interesting. So, you know, I might go to an LGBTQ kind of event, or I might go to a neurodivergence event. This, you know, so you might see me pop up several places.
Yeah. And just thinking of your own intersectionality. So, obviously, you've talked about being diagnosed with ADHD. Mm-hmm. So you were saying about 18 months ago. How's that been for you? Did that explain your life, as I've heard lots of people talk about, or just give you more comfort, or not?
I didn't really, well, let's say it wasn't about explaining my life. So I think it helped me to understand some of the patterns that have happened in my life.
Yeah.
It helped me explain the reasons why I might have been flighty in the past. It helped me explain issues I've had previously with being quite risky, you know, taking risks. I've previously got myself into trouble several times. You know, thankfully I work with people that can look beyond that. I think that's why it was really important to me. It wasn't important to anybody else. I think, you know, with the people I work with, they kind of like, yeah, well, we kind of know that. But it was important for me. And it really shone a light on my own behaviors, my own history. So I found it absolutely fascinating. And I know, you know, I've been privileged to go through that process. You know, it's not easy. Certainly in the UK, there's waiting lists everywhere for those kinds of things. But yeah, if there's ways of doing it and, you know, you're on a waiting list or whatever, persevere. It's really worth it. Absolutely loved it.
Yeah,
and in terms of the intersectionality bit, I mean, after being in New York and then coming back to the UK, I was always quite open then. And I've always been quite open about being LGBTQ in jobs I've been in. So previous to Genius Within, I was at the, you know, the local authority, as I mentioned, and I was always open there. I think I got fed up with it as a kid. I didn't want to keep hiding anymore. So that pushed that more so than the overlap with, you know, having a diagnosis. It has made me less fearful. You know, I'm quite more likely to challenge things.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of benefit to understanding yourself in whatever guise that is, whether it's getting a diagnosis of something or whether it's just, you know, speaking to a good friend about what you're going through and what that means and what that might do for you in the future, sort of thing. I think there is great value in understanding who we are and why we make the decisions that we make. I certainly know that. I mean, I kind of almost don't feel like I need to go and get a diagnosis of things, because I'd be very surprised if I didn't come out as inattentive ADHD, as an example. Because there's so many things that I look at now and in the past where I just kind of meet the very obvious kind of tick boxes for it.
Let's not skirt around that, because I think self-identity is equally as important. So there's a lot of, you know, we see a lot of negative press, I think, from the mainstream media about, oh yeah, everyone's ADHD these days. And there's been some horrible articles in the press in the last year. And we still see them. Self-ID is really important. Most of the people that are actually now getting formal diagnosis are people that had self-ID before and were right. And I think that's really important to recognize. So, you know, nobody knows your own body like you do. You know, nobody knows your brain like you do.
Yeah. And I'm very blasé about a lot of things these days. I never used to be, actually, interestingly. So when I was younger, if somebody said to me I was disabled, I wouldn't have even really understood what that was, if I'm completely honest, and what that meant. But I would have probably told them to F off, because I was against being late. I did everything possible to fit into being normal, in inverted commas. Like that, I just didn't want to be different. I put on as many masks as I possibly could do.
Yeah.
To fit in to be brought out. I never did. I never felt like I fit in. I never felt like I was part of kind of groups in any real meaningful kind of form. And, you know, all that kind of hiding does, and this is why I think self-exploration is really important, because all that hiding does and is, it's me having a life where I felt different or excluded or, you know, just not part of in whatever the guise that might have been. And then you have kind of masking elements that is just blooming exhausting. And eventually that gets to a point where it wears you down.
Yeah.
You then start, you know, other things then come in. Self-doubt comes in. You know, depression comes in. Anxiety starts to come out. And I think a lot of the kind of press stuff around, oh, there's so much ADHD now, it's just wrong. It's that it's not that there's so much now, it's that the services have been so poor historically at identifying.
Absolutely.
That we just didn't know it was around. I mean,
yeah.
I cannot think of anybody when I was younger that was defined as being ADHD, that had a diagnosis. And I went to a relatively big school, lots of people, probably over 100 people just in my year sort of thing. I think that says as much as it needs to say, whereas now,
plenty. It's interesting. I think back in when I was at school, you know, kids were just treated as willfully disobedient or naughty, or, you know, even then they were using naughty child syndrome, weren't they, or whatever they called it, something really derogatory, I seem to remember. So yeah, so they say, you know, there wasn't ADHD around, but you know it was around, it just wasn't formally diagnosed then, or it wasn't given a label, or it's always been around. I think it's, you know, we've got quite an interesting history, but the press nowadays is not making it easier. I think it, you know, tends to make it harder.
No, there is a slight irony in the press talking so much about it, though, in that one of the things that it kind of makes me want to go and get a diagnosis, because actually it's a bit of an FU to the press and to the people that are kind of naysayers around it. Well, actually, I should have been diagnosed when I was younger for a variety of different reasons. That didn't happen.
Yeah.
That's not my fault. That's not a negative on me. That's to a certain extent the way it was. I don't like using that kind of phrase, because the way it was is probably never the way it should have been. And it's almost an acknowledgement, isn't it? When we say, oh, it's just the way it was. It's just where people were. All that stuff.
Yeah.
It's just an acknowledgement of the status quo. Actually, what we should always be doing is challenging that status quo and trying to be better, trying to achieve more, trying to be the kind of change makers, to use some of the kind of language from the Disability Power 100 kind of list. It's all about people that can make change, adapt change, and make a difference.
We have a history of conforming, though, don't we, in the UK?
Yeah, we do. We're well versed in that, which can be good. Probably
sometimes
isn't good.
Yeah,
in the main, though.
Looking back when I was younger, if I could tell my younger self now to be more open and, you know, and challenge more, then of course I would. But back at, you know, at that point, you do want to fit in. And, you know, you talked about masking. Mm-hmm. I mean, I masked all the time to fit in with the boys. I didn't want, you know, when I was not out of the closet at school, I didn't want the boys to know, you know, I didn't want them to think less of me. And I did try and fit in, but internally in your head, you know, you know you don't fit in. So you can fit in from their perspective, but internally you're going, I don't fit in with this group. I don't fit in with these people, you know. So it's a huge fight in your own brain space all of the time when you're doing that. It's very tricky.
Yeah, and I could talk about coming out not in the kind of traditional sense of it, from a coming out of the closet of being gay, bisexual, etc. But coming out as disabled is my coming out, because I was one of those people that was relatively fortunate, I guess, in that, you know, I was born with bilateral telepaths, surgeries and stuff when I was properly little. But I've always had pain. I've never been able to do the same things that other kids would do. But I was always that kid that was like, oh, you look like an athlete if you look at my upper body. Look like an athlete, look like someone that's about to do like amazing things. And then you get me running and I'd be like 10 seconds behind everybody else. sort of thing. And like, I just didn't even think about it at all. So you kind of hide lots and lots of stuff.
You do.
And eventually that's got to come out. And I think the kind of coming out kind of stories that they hear in the LGBTQI plus community in particular, almost maybe think about it more, that actually I need to be more of my real self. And I think that's where the kind of storytelling, the story sharing, and that kind of lived experience piece is important.
And I, do you know what? It takes balls to do it. And I mean, you know, it wasn't even that long ago when I wouldn't have wanted to do it. I think it depends who you're surrounded with. You know, initially I always found it hard, but as I matured, I would guess, then I got to a point where I didn't care what people thought. Like, I'm going to be me. I'm just going to be me, you know. And I'm you know, similarly, I with other health conditions and hidden things, you know, I don't class myself as disabled, you know, being neurodivergent and having other health things, you know, because people would look at me and go, well, you know, you're physically able. And again, that's a kind of negative that you know, I could quite easily go and get a blue badge tomorrow. But it's one of those things that, you know, society frowns on because we're not there yet. And I think that's one of the hardest things to try and broach. So yeah, coming out as disabled or coming out as LGBTQ, you know, coming out as trans, the more we talk about these things, I think the better society will be and better work, you know, be better in workplaces. So yeah, come out,
everybody. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, well, just be yourself. That's one message, I think, from this. And may well end up being kind of in the title of this is about being your true self, because if for anything else or if nothing else, it means that you can have a more fulfilling experience in life.
It's interesting
to say about getting a blue badge and or not getting a blue badge and that kind of hidden aspect of kind of health conditions, that is who I have been my entire life. I would even refuse to use crutches when I was younger because I didn't want to be seen as different. I wanted to be me. So when I was limping into the office when I was getting into work and stuff, it was also always the typical question was, what have you done? Because I was limping. Just football injury. But it was because my arthritis was hideously bad at that moment. And I was in so much pain that I was about to pass out. But I wouldn't tell anybody that.
Yeah, nowadays I'm quite proud to get my walking stick out.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, be your authentic self is definitely a thing. And you know, it is about self-worth, and it's also about, you know, good mental health. But to be honest, I'd quite also like to see it inspire other people. You know, I don't want to be a leader, you know, that's not what I'm saying, but actually if we're comfortable talking about things that traditionally have been quite uncomfortable, other people will start talking, you know, it will inspire younger people to be open. And you know, you look at Gen Z now and they're like, oh yeah, they talk about their friends at school, oh, so and so's trans, so and so's gay, oh yeah, great, thanks, what are we having for dinner now then? And they just move on. So I think, you know, things do improve, but I think that, you know, current government is doing its damnedest to ruin it, but I think, you know, we will see change. I think people are far more open to differences now, and I think that's a good thing.
Hopefully it will long continue. I do see a lot of positives in the kind of younger generation. I've got two young kids, and part of the reason that I probably speak out now more than I ever did was because I want to ensure that next generation don't make the same mistakes that I did. Quite simply, don't hide things when they need to use something to stop being in so much pain. I mean, how ridiculous was I? just an Egypt as my
No.
Friends would say.
You know, like you say, it's masking. But, it's how you felt then.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is one of those things that I've got a couple of kind of quick fire questions for you, and then one bigger one. Sure. ADHD or neurodivergence as a whole, superpower or not?
Well, for me, and on behalf of Genius Within, not a superpower. I know it can have quite a positive impact for individuals, but actually it can also have a negative impact on others. I don't think people realize quite what there's a dichotomy of the struggle. So yes, when you're really doing really great and you're working to your strengths, it can seem like a superpower. But on the other hand, you have crashing down times and, you know, these really awful periods where it's like, wow, I can't be superpowered because, you know, I can't even get out of bed today. So yeah, it's because of that. It's such a dichotomy in using that narrative. So yeah, for me, no.
And the other one that I kind of know what you're going to say, but I'll ask it anyway. Should DE&I die?
Should DE&I die? Absolutely not.
Yeah.
I think DE&I needs to be more inclusive. I think DE&I or DE&I, whatever anybody wants to call it, inclusion and belonging, needs to include everybody. I think, you know, far too often we focus on one strand, and I can understand why, but I think until we look at our communities as a whole, we won't get an understanding of how to support our employees, our colleagues, our staff, you know, our students. So yeah, I think it has a really important part to play, and businesses should be funding it appropriately if they're supporting it. 100%.
Wholeheartedly agree. It's been making the rounds at the moment on lots of different social media platforms, but in particular on LinkedIn. And every time I see it, I just sigh.
Yeah,
just annoys me. I'm just gonna
add something in there. I do see it go around on social media, and I think it's quite funny when it goes around, because you will see lots of people that kind of, I call it the DE&I cash cow. So people will go around and they'll sell, you know, events or whatever for all of these various things, and actually don't get anything from it, and nothing ever moves, you know, it doesn't move on to something else. I think for people that are serious about DE&I, taking that step to be more inclusive and actually thinking, even if it's just insular within your own company, thinking about how to be more inclusive, I think they have a really important role, you know, regardless of what's going on externally. You know, look at yourselves first. I think it'll work.
Ultimately, they can be the change. So
they can.
If you're going to do it, like you say, then do it properly. Make sure that it's covering all the different populations, which includes the kind of larger population. So it includes those, you know, cis white males in their 40s, 50s, 60s. Because equally, and I saw it in previous firms in particular, you can get to a point where that community starts feeling excluded as much as anything else. And that's not good quality inclusivity.
That's no, anything. I agree.
You're just benefiting one to exclude another. That's not what the aim should be.
There's a great post, a real funny post by Lee Chambers today, if any of you know of Lee Chambers on LinkedIn. So he's put a post up about being pale, male and stale, which is the phrase that's doing the rounds at the minute. Well, I'm pale, I am male, and I'm pretty much stale. So, but yeah, I'm not. So go do one.
Yeah, there's a lot of that sort of thing. You just think, it just
it's
doesn't
derogatory. Cover
what it should.
No,
it's derogatory. It's not needed. It doesn't help anybody. It doesn't even help the communities that it's trying to help either. Because
no, it really doesn't.
Ultimately, you've got to get people on side. You've got to engage in the conversation in a way that is going to enable growth rather than disable that growth.
Absolutely.
I feel like I'm using loads of buzzwords.
Well, you know, the thing to add on to that as well about being pale, male and stale is actually the average age for any adult to, you know, acquire a disability is around 53.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're going to have an older workforce that will fall into the DE&I category, whether you like it or not. And I think we need to also recognize that. And we want to retain staff. You know, age is not a thing. You know, we've kind of gone past that. So, you know, look after everybody. include everybody.
It goes back to that diversity of thought, all these different experiences, all these different cultures, ages, lived experiences. They all have to be part of that pot and that kind of cauldron that creates the environments we want to work to, and that ultimately creates lots of money for people that own these organizations. So there is that kind of benefit, however gross that feels to kind of talk to. The last one then, and I'll let you go. So this is one that I'm asking every single guest this season on the show. How do you want to be remembered?
Ooh, how do I want to be remembered? To be honest, I'm not sure that I particularly want to be remembered for anything other than by my close friends and family. You know, I am outspoken, but I don't want to be remembered as being some outspoken buffoon or, you know, a change leader. I see all these buzzwords all the time. If anything, I want to be remembered for being shot into space in a can or something stupid like that. Like Scotty off of Star Trek. That's what I'd really like.
That'd be amazing. That's probably the best answer I've got so far. It's one of those questions that I think says a lot about people in the kind of that your first thing was to say about how you want your family to remember you. So it kind of shows how meaningful that is to you, how important the kind of local communication, local contacts that you've got, be that family, be that friends, are to you. And I think it just says a lot about who you are and the important things in your life, which is quite an endearing thing to talk about.
Yeah. Well, my friends are my family, really. I'm not as fortunate as you to have got to the point where I could have had kids. So I'm quite happy being not having them now at 50. I think I'd probably find them a handful. I won't have a generation to pass down to, but I've got nieces and nephews and cousins, and you know, the wider family's big, and my friends network is a huge, they are my family, my friends network. So yeah, absolutely. And of course I've got my Genius Within family.